Nightlife.
Through the years, we've seen numerous ads telling us to stop smoking, put sunscreen on and drive safely. Slip, slap, slop, stop, revive, survive, dumb ways to die. They're slogans that really do stick in your head. But do public health and safety campaigns work? What are the public health and safety messages you remember the most? Did any of them change your behaviour? Tonight, we thought we'd have a look at the successful ones, the duds, the all-important question, are they necessary in the first place? Joining me in studio tonight is Adam Ferrier, consumer psychologist and chief strategy officer at Cummins Ross. Adam, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Very good. And Mike Daube also with us tonight, a professor of health policy at Curtin University, director of the Public Health Advocacy Institute and the McCusker Centre for Action on Alcohol and Youth. Mike, I think we know which side of the argument you're on.
Pretty good guess.
Adam, I'll start with you. Looking back, when did we first start seeing public health and safety campaigns develop in this country? Was it 70s?
I think in the 70s we got introduced to Norm and Life Begin It, and then in the 80s we had some quite iconic campaigns such as the ones you mentioned in the introduction, Slip, Slop, Slap, and the Grim Reaper. And I think it's kind of like the 80s have been seen as the heyday of these kind of public service announcements. And in those days, these ads would become quite iconic and part of popular culture, and people would be talking about them and lampooning them and parodying them, potentially or arguably a lot more than they are now.
You've got to say that a couple of the slogans I still remember, the one that was on the side of a bus regarding condom use, if it's not on, it's not on, right? Which I thought was quite clever. And, despite the fact quite a few years have passed since the launch and that, it still does stick.
Yeah, I think some of the reasons why some of these, if we go back to the 80s just for a second, talk about those, some of the reasons why these ads stuck was because they were hammered into our head infinitum with massive media spends and had a degree of longevity that you rarely see in these types of campaigns these days. So Slip, Slop, Slap was around for many years before they kind of try to change it a little bit unsuccessfully by adding on another two S's, but I think we had the gift of greater media spends, and then they use kind of clever little things like jingles and so forth, which have gone a little bit out of favour with advertisers these days as well.
I was involved with that Grim Reaper campaign in the, I think it was 86, 87. We did a survey before we did the campaign, and in, July of that particular year, we found that 2% had actually heard of AIDS or had any idea about what it was. And we did a follow-up campaign 6 months after Grim Reaper, and we had a 97% recall. Those sort of public health campaigns, obviously are very rare. Mike, what do you think of that particular campaign?
Well, that was a dramatic campaign, and Adam's absolutely right. In the 70s, what we had was grey-haired doctors talking at your television screens, telling you what you should do, and that wasn't the way to go. In the 80s, we had a bit of a revolution. We started using the same kind of approaches that commercial advertisers use. We had strong campaigns. We had brilliant campaigns, whether it's HIV/AIDS or the wonderful John Bevins sponge ads on tobacco and some of those. And I think Adam's right that they were new and they were different, so they were more noticed. They had actually, from my recollection, and I ran some of those campaigns, they actually had very modest budgets, but we were pretty damn good at getting them publicity and drawing attention to them in other forms of media, and they were sustained. So the slip slap message didn't suffer from what a lot of health campaigns suffer from, which is particularly governments wanting to change the approach every 10 minutes. They stayed with it. So I think the Grim Reaper was a great ad. Some others were. But now we do have the problem that we don't have the budgets we need to compete with commercial advertisers. And, of course, we're trying to achieve massive behavioural change, often people doing things they don't like doing. when commercial advertisers are looking for tiny behavioural changes with much bigger budgets and much more freedom. So, you know, I think we need to keep going with this advertising. And in answer to your questions, does it work? Well, just look at the trends on smoking over the last 30 years or so. And do we need it? Yes, because it saves lives.
Mike, does it have to be a multi-level strategy as well? I mean, obviously, there's been substantial price hikes as far as smoking is concerned. And that obviously has encouraged people to think with their pocket.
Well, it needs to be multi-level in various ways. You know, a lot of politicians will tell you that the reason that we were able, for example, to ban tobacco advertising was because there had been those great quick campaigns that drew public attention to the need for action on smoking and the magnitude of the problem. But always, always, I think, we've got to be aware that we shouldn't be subject to the need to prove instant success with advertising, short-term advertising campaigns on their own. They've got to be sustained, they've got to be long-term then, they've got to be adequately funded, and they've got to be part of a comprehensive approach. So to take tobacco, you need the media campaigns, you need tax, you need health warnings, you need measures to protect non-smoking. The public education campaigns aren't the answer on their own, but they're a crucial part of the overall program, which works much better. Example, if there's a price increase and nobody knows about it, then it doesn't, you know, it has some impact, but people won't act on it, draw attention to it, and they sure do want to quit.
Yeah. Adam, some concepts that you've got to get across in these campaigns are quite difficult. For example, at one stage during the 80s, we had to explain as a federal government that you shouldn't use drugs, but if you did use intravenous drugs, you should do with a clean needle. And that's an odd double message, which obviously succeeded because there was very few infections along the double use of needles line.
Yeah, and there's two ways I guess I could answer that. The first one is it's a lot of these kind of campaigns are just raising awareness about the issue. So they're not necessarily trying to change behaviour in and of themselves. They're trying to make people aware of all the other tactics that are going on, as was just explained. The other more interesting thing I think though, what's happening now is the marketing communications landscape has changed. So TV and radio and so on are no longer passive mediums. They're fully interactive, and I think it's 75% of all TV viewing is done with a laptop on your lap or a smartphone in your hand. That means that all communications can now be interactive, and so now we can actually command people to take the first step towards doing whatever behaviour change it is that we're asking them to do. And if you can just get them to act for a small little way, maybe it's just like a cause on Facebook or start a small journey today with the first step, whatever it is that you want them to do, then if you can get them to do one thing towards that behavioural change, and no matter how small it is, then they're on the way to making a bigger change as well.
Adam, it's particularly tricky early on to sell that slip, slap, slop message simply because I think a lot of people felt, if you had a tan, you look really healthy. And so, therefore, it was a good thing, particularly if you were going out on, hitting the bars or whatever you were going to do that particular weekend. And to get people to understand that melanoma and melanoma death in this country was extraordinary, it took a while to, defeat that in your mind.
Yeah, and again, I think one of the beauty of Slip, Slop, Slap was it didn't try to explain all of that. It just said, do these things because it's safe for you. And then if you did that in a kind of catchy kind of way, then you're suddenly acting as if you're part of the issue, or you're part of the communications, you're part of the cause. I mean, we recently did something for the Cancer Council where we created a rapper who was an albino, and his name was Albino, and he rapped about how good it was to be fair skinned, and the song, which was created with a hip hop artist called Lyrics Born, was called "It's a Beautiful Day for Cancer." Now that obviously you get cancer you get skin cancer if it's too hot and it's down unprotected. So that again was it was just a nice little song, a catchy little ditty. But then if you start to sing that to yourself, then perhaps you start to ask yourself, well, what does this really mean? What's the relationship between sun exposure and cancer and so forth? And so you start to work it out for yourself a bit.
Yeah. Mike, obviously you were suggesting that, you know, these government campaigns don't have a lot of money behind them. And particularly, I guess, the big issue that we have at the moment is us getting bigger. And when you have a look at the fast food campaigns that are out there, you know, there's barely an ad break on TV without one. And so it's pretty hard to push the celery when you're being bombarded from the other side.
Absolutely. It's a huge problem. We faced it with tobacco until we got rid of tobacco advertising. We're facing it now with alcohol, where we'll be swamped with alcohol promotion. And in the food area, there's massive commercial opposition, billions of dollars going into promoting junk. Now, that's where something like HIV/AIDS or skin cancer are different, because there's nobody actually out there who's promoting HIV/AIDS, no opposition, no commercial opposition or on skin cancer. So what you have, the obstacles you have with mass media, public education on obesity are you have massive commercial opposition, you have very limited funding. You have governments that don't want to put out very often, don't want to put out the hard messages themselves. And you were just talking earlier about the difficulty there is with the food rating website in even getting some basic information up on a website. So you have governments that don't want to get out hard messages, and the funding that's available to health organisations is limited. So now in Western Australia, where I am, the Heart Foundation and Cancer Council are running a great campaign called Live Lighter, and that's really tough. That's showing the damage that obesity can do and is getting some hard messages across, and I think that's the sort of thing we need to see more of. Some people may not like it, but if you don't get the hard messages across, then we just aren't going to see any change. And as far as obesity goes, you know, we're one of the fattest countries in the world. We're not quite on the podium, but we're getting there. And we need some really tough measures. Always, though, coming back to the point you made earlier, as part of a comprehensive approach, it's not just mass media. We need to curb some of that massive industry promotion. And until we do that, a lot of our work is just a pin to stop a herd of elephants.
Adam, obviously working for an advertising agency, you have a view that you know, advertising shouldn't be crimped, but it is an argument, I guess, to say that perhaps in children's viewing hours it should be a bit limited. Do you have a view?
Yeah, I do have a view. It's a sensitive issue, and I totally agree with Mike that it's, you know, if you have a whole bunch of food manufacturers out there all kind of promoting their product, every single one of them's allowed to promote their product and has a right to try to make a profit and sell their brands. But the cumulative impact of all of those voices saying, eat me, eat me, eat me, can be quite bombarding on the poor consumer. And so then to have another little voice saying, hey, yeah, but eat responsibly, that little voice kind of gets lost in this onslaught. I don't know what the answer is, but I certainly empathise with the issue.
Yeah. Dumb Ways to Die. The song became an instant hit in 2012, and I guess this is partly what you're talking about, Adam. Sometimes, it starts out as a mainstream commercial, but it's picked up on the web and the like. Public service announcement by Metro Trains in Melbourne to promote rail safety. Adam, why do you think it worked?
I think it's a very good question. I think they just got all the different elements right. It's a nice idea. It's very cute. It's got a nice jingle. It creates an earworm or a little song that sticks in your head. The song itself is catchy. The execution of this is beautiful. It appeals to it works at two levels, where it appeals to kids and it appeals to adults. The kids just see cute little characters running around, but they get the message. The adults also like it as well, because you know that they find it funny. So I think it's just a beautiful piece of craft advertising that works. And also there's something kind of salacious and risky in talking about dumb ways to die. It's just a new thought that people haven't really considered before, but you really are stupid if you decide to get run over by a train.
Mike, is this part of the way you do these sort of commercials these days? You literally have to challenge the people to listen.
You absolutely do. You have to get their attention, because when you're on limited budgets, you have to be sometimes even that bit more creative. And sometimes when governments maybe lack courage, that can be hard, which is why often these days some of the best campaigns are run from outside government. I think that Dumb Ways to Die campaign was a really good one. It happened to be a really good ad. You know, when you get good creatives, you want to hang on to them and come up with bright ideas. Trouble is often in health, though, they want to go over the top. And we're different from people in the commercial arena in that we are absolutely bound by the evidence. We cannot go beyond the evidence, and we can't speculate. We've got to be rock solid in what we're saying, because people look to us as health authorities. So that's a constraint. But I think the New South Wales campaign was a good one, but it was something of a one-off. And everything I've learned about media campaigns is that if you're dealing with long-term behaviours, you have to keep going. You have to be persistent. And that's what's happened with tobacco. And even if you look at HIV/AIDS, anybody who was watching Senate estimates today to see what was happening about the food rating stuff, and to see Senator Nash, the hapless Senator Nash, getting yet more of a grilling, anyone watching that would also have seen the highly respected Commonwealth Government's chief medical officer saying that, you know, there are concerns about HIV/AIDS. We've probably got a bit too complacent. So, you know, the Grim Reaper was a long time ago. Kids listening now won't remember the Grim Reaper. And we've got to keep at it and not just run one-off campaigns and then think we solved the problem.
Mm. Adam, sometimes these advertisements get quite graphic. I have to say that whenever the anti-smoking ad comes on, where it starts to go down into your gullet and seeing bits and pieces of the body doing nasty stuff, you know, it switches me off completely. Is this a real risk? If you get too graphic, people will just shut it out.
They've done some. The research is quite hard to tease out what's the cause and effect and what works and what doesn't in this stuff, because it's so multifaceted and so complicated. However, I guess there's general generalizations. Emotive types of ads seem to work better than rational types of ads, so the ads that appeal to our emotions. And then on those types of ads, you can split those into two types: the ones that evoke a positive emotion, and the ones that evoke a negative emotion and kind of shock us. The shock ads have been kind of historically what have been used in kind of preventative behaviours types of things. So, you know, don't drive too fast, don't drink drive, don't smoke. Let's shock you into changing that behaviour. However, what's really interesting, and it's actually happening mainly in Western Australia again, is that they've started to take a positive approach and trying to elicit positive emotions to try to change these behaviours. So the campaign, which is Enjoy the Ride, asks people to slow down just by creating a positive emotion associated with driving slowly rather than trying to shock people into not speeding. And I think I think they're getting quite good evidence to show that actually we've been kind of hoodwinked a little bit by advertising agencies just want to shock and awe people. And in fact, maybe trying to elicit a few positive emotions around behaviour change is a good way to go.
Yeah. Mike, do you also find that perhaps the last 15 to 20% of the people who smoke are hardcore, and no matter what you say, they're not going to change their attitudes?
No. That's a bit of a myth. You know, people talk about it hardening and so on. I've been hearing that when smoking was at 35% and 30%, and you'll never get it below 25% and so on, and it keeps coming down. And if there's one that we really have learned, we need to keep going with those approaches, as well as support for people who want to quit. But hard hitting campaigns do work. And that was one of the big lessons, one of the big mistakes we made even 30 years ago. You know, we'd have these bright, sunny ads and people breaking through the clouds to break free of smoking. They didn't achieve a thing. We'd have ads that were aimed at kids, little cartoon characters. I remember one we ran in WA aimed at kids, Only Dags Need Fags. And I remember that particularly because I was running that campaign for the government at the time, and I got one complaint about it, and it was from a Mr. and Mrs. Dagg in Bunbury. But
nice.
You know, the of course you need some information ads and different conditions or whatever will need different approaches, but by and large, hard hitting does work, but not over the top, and you have to reject some of the agency's best ideas and send the creatives away weeping.
Mike, you were part of the process that got the plain packaging happening. Do you think that's an important part of the, you know, regime as well?
I think it's really important and fundamentally important for a range of reasons. And it also comes back to something that Adam talked about when he talked about research. These days, the only decent health campaigns are well-researched, and similarly with plain packaging. It was research-based. Everything about it is research-based. The colour of the pack, the warnings you show and so on, it's all based on meticulous research. Is it going to stop everybody smoking overnight? No, that's not the case, but it's part of that comprehensive approach. It takes away from tobacco manufacturers their last remaining means of promotion. It gets messages across. It turns a cigarette pack from a fashion accessory to something really ugly. And then, apart from the research, you start to get anecdotal. A few days after plain packaging came in, and I chaired the committee that expert committee that recommended plain packaging, and I might say so far the research evidence is very encouraging of its impact. But a few days after it came in, I had to leave home early to do a television interview, and they wanted some packs, and I don't keep them at home, so I popped into a supermarket to pick up some plain package, you know, some of the new packs. And the young woman behind the counter, who didn't know me from a hole in the ground, when she handed them over to me, she pointed at one of the packs and said, "That made me quit." So, you know, we've got the research evidence. Yeah. There's also anecdotal evidence. And I think it's what we need to keep driving smoking down, because we can win that battle.
Adam, you're a big supporter of plain packaging, despite working in the advertising industry. What's been your experience?
My dad was a pack-a-day Marlboro Red smoker all his life. And then he died of cancer. And this is in Western Australia. And he had his coffin painted as a box of Marlboro Reds. And then when he died, he asked me to give his eulogy, and he said, "Say whatever you want, Adam, but let them know he want that he was cremated so he could light up one last time." So that was last week. No, it wasn't. That was a joke. So it was some years ago now.
Yeah.
That was in 1997. But you know, so his whole point was it's freedom of choice, and I guess it's a double-edged sword, because it's freedom of choice that will ultimately kill you. It's probably the only product in the world that if you use it exactly as the manufacturers intend, it will kill you. I think it's wonderful what we've done, but it's not just the advertising. It's plain packaging. It's limiting the advertising. It's increasing the price. It's legislation for smoking and only in outside areas and so on and so on. And it's all those things. It takes a multimodal approach to put all the nails in the coffin.
If you need to text tonight, 0467 922 702, 0467 922 702. Trev has already done that, and he says, "G'day, Tony. A good ad at the moment. Stop speeding with the doctor saying choose wisely. Late or crush your daughter's skull." And he said, "It really sticks with me."
Yeah, I like that as well. I like it because it's open ended, and it invites the consumer in to make up their own mind in terms of and get involved in the piece of communications rather than just force something on you.
Yeah. Another SMS says, "Hey, Tony, just YouTubed Dumb Ways to Die. Lots of laugh. Brilliant." David from Graceful says, "Why haven't there been more anti-drug campaigns?"
Well, can I perhaps take that one on board?
Absolutely.
Back in the 80s, you may remember there was a big drug summit when Bob Hawke was Prime Minister.
I do.
I think his family had some drug problems. There are some real risks with anti-drug campaigns. There's an enormous risk that you simply popularise the problem and make people more aware of it. And with illicit drugs, which you know, although much more than we'd like in some areas, still relatively low, we've got to be incredibly careful that we don't normalise illicit drug use. We've got to be very careful that our communications are targeted. As you were pointing out too earlier, some of the communications are pretty nuanced. They're not just about illicit drug use, but sometimes their campaigns addressed to illicit drug users about what they do. Mm. And, you know, it can be a bit populist for people to say, let's run huge anti-drug campaigns. We, first and foremost, the biggest killers among our drugs are tobacco and alcohol. They're still far too widely used. With illicit drugs, we need good information. Mm. And we also need good information on pharmaceutical drugs and so on, but we've got to be much more careful and nuanced about that.
If it's a niche behaviour and it's hard to change, then broadcast communications isn't necessarily the right vehicle to use. I was once asked to get involved in a campaign in Austria to help get pedophiles to seek treatment. The only way pedophiles can get treatment at the moment is if they're caught. So I don't think Australia is ready for a mass market campaign along those kind of lines.
Adam, I've got to say, I also was involved in a selection process at one point to have a look at an ad campaign that was run in Liverpool in northern England. Mm-hmm. And it was essentially designed to make an intravenous drug user look pretty decrepit
You're the one responsible for making it cool.
Well, this was the problem. We did testing on it. We had about 400, 500 kids of the appropriate age having a look at it. And they went, oh, no, he looks pretty cool. No, I like it. And so we canned that immediately. That was a very poor idea.
Yeah, look, that can happen all the time. And I think Drinkwise has just released actually today a campaign asking people to drink responsibly. Now, they use the word, I'm going to swear here, they use the words shit and fuck in the piece of communications, which mm-hmm. is quite amazing that they've done that. Now, the risk is that it's going to make this ad look really, really cool and make drink dry, make, you know, getting really drunk kind of appealing, but hopefully it doesn't.
Yeah. Can I just comment on that? Because
absolutely.
I've seen that online. I think that's an outrageous communication, and that Drinkwise, which is an alcohol industry organisation, should be ashamed of themselves and they should withdraw that. This is a campaign through social media and so on, as far as I can see, which is actually about promoting drinking. It's telling people, and that can be young people because kids will be watching and looking at the internet and so on, it's telling people how they should drink. It's encouraging drinking. And sure, there's the sort of undercurrent that we're trying to teach them to drink sensibly. But I think this is the most outrageous campaign that I've ever seen purporting as public education. And I've no doubt that it's going to be harmful. And I cannot understand how even an alcohol industry group could be running a campaign like that. I think it should be withdrawn before it starts.
Wow.
Mm, you heard it here. Adam Ferrier is with us tonight, consumer psychologist and chief strategy officer at advertising agency Cummins Ross, and also Mike Daub, professor of health policy at Curtin University and director of the Public Health Advocacy Institute and McCusker Centre for Action on Alcohol and Youth. And I'm wondering whether you'd like to join us. Perhaps there have been campaigns that you've seen, you've really liked, and have perhaps change the way you think about a particular issue, or you've seen it work with other people around you. Perhaps there's ones also that you've seen which you thought were total duds and a waste of space.
Nightlife.
Adam Ferrier with us tonight from Cummins Ross, and Mike Daub, who's a professor of health policy at Curtin University, and we're talking about issues relating to community campaigns. Des, you're remembering an effective grassroots campaign that was against smoking in WA.
Good evening, Tony, Adam, Mike.
Evening, Des.
Hi.
It was early 80s, and it was in the days when you had massive hoardings along the railway lines and the highways and that sort of thing in Western Australia. And I'm not sure whether it was an Australia-wide thing, but promoting smoking and that sort of thing. And there was a group called Bugger Up, And I'm not quite sure whether you were involved with that, Michael, or not, just from memory, but it was BUGA, and they used to go around and actually put these anti-smoking messages on these smoking advertisements, and they were quite, you know, they were persistent with putting their messages across, basically just in spray paint and that sort of thing. And so, like, it was quite... Yeah, and it went for quite a while until basically advertising of cigarettes and smoking and that sort of thing ceased, you know.
It was brilliant. There were some of the people involved, you know. It was mainly medical students and others, and some of them now incredibly respectable doctors. But they were so outraged by cigarette advertising, they went around graffitiing it. And putting more appropriate slogans on the cigarette ads, so you know, instead of where it just said Brand X, it would say Brand X gives you lung cancer or something like that. And some of them were really clever slogans they had. Brilliant campaign, drew attention to how atrocious cigarette advertising was. And the bad news is, you know, although most of the best things come out of WA, it happened in the other states as well.
Thanks for raising it, Des. Stan, you're saying it really comes down to legislation, not advertising.
Well, what's the point of advertising if the legislators don't step in and reduce the allowable nicotine that makes the cigarettes addictive? I would propose that over a 5 or 10 year period, that 10 or 15% or say 20% of the nicotine addictive content of the cigarette is legislated as the maximum that has to be reduced per year. By the time you get to year 5 or 10, whatever it's going to be decided, you would now have a product that advertising would basically let people quit. But why do you leave it addictive? I don't see it working. My mother died from emphysema after smoking for nearly 45, probably close to 50 years, and it never helped her. But if you legislated it to reduce the addictive content of it, in my world of construction, I can't buy a tin of house paint that's got lead in it. Well, you can't buy building products with asbestos, so just reduce the nicotine content.
Mike?
This government will allow the content to stay high.
Look, I empathise with what a caller was saying. It's not just nicotine. There's a whole range of things that that make cigarettes addictive. But what I think is really important, what he's saying is, and it's really what Adam said, is that we need the mass media campaigns. We need the comprehensive approach to restrictions on smoking in public places and so on. I think with tobacco, which, as Adam said, it's the only consumer product that kills 1 in 2 of its regular users when used precisely as intended, and about 6 million people each year around the globe. You know, this is a lethal product produced by an evil industry. I think we need to start moving to the next questions about what we do, not just about price, but about maybe should we be reducing the number of sales outlets that we have for tobacco. There are so many, it's so easily accessible. So I think we need to think again a bit more creatively about what we do through legislation. We can't ban smoking overnight, but I think we should now be looking to see what we can do over the next 10 years or so that actually will bring it down even more dramatically.
Yeah. Stan, thanks so much for raising it. Lynn, you also think some illegal drug advertisements almost encourage their use.
Yes. I have thought that ever since the illegal drug advertisements came out. On the one hand, it tells you, unlike the cigarette ads or the anti-smoking, and I'm a non-smoker, by the way, that actually say don't do it. On the illicit drug advertisements, it's, well, you shouldn't do it, but we will show you how to do it. And it's whether it's in the newspapers, the television, or even over the radio, I've heard advertisements. So I'm, as an elderly person, I'm a bit confused now as to exactly why we're banning cigarettes when we're really not banning illicit drugs. Mm. And why aren't they going and explaining exactly what is in cigarettes? It's not just the nicotine, it's all the chemicals. The amount of... I mean, I come from a smoking family. My dad and my mum smoked. And the tobacco that my father used to have is totally different now to the tobacco that you can get even as far as the raw tobacco. I think it's more the chemicals, more than the actual tobacco itself. I believe now it's more the chemicals that are they're putting into the tobacco, mixing with the tobacco, that's more the killer. But I'd prefer to see the illegal ads advertisements saying don't take it, instead of on the softly, softly approach where, if you take an illegal drug, you may die, but if you're going to smoke a normal cigarette, you will die. I really am a bit confused, as you can hear.
There's some interesting research that looks at... they got a whole lot of kids, and they said that they had a cookie jar, and they said to a whole lot of kids, don't eat that cookie in the cookie jar. To others, they just ignored the cookies in the cookie jar, and to other people, they rewarded them every time they had a cookie. The group that ate the most cookies were the group that told, don't eat the cookie in the cookie jar. So there is something to be said for, if soon as you say don't do something, that people kind of will, for whatever reason, if there's ever forces at play, will start to do things. I think to the caller, you can take heart in the fact that a lot that, as Mike said, all of these campaigns that have been done now are researched to the hilt, and so they're based on sound insights that will make them work. And if they're not working or having a reverse effect, then they're going to get pulled or stopped very, very quickly.
Yeah, Lynn, thank you very much for raising that issue. Jerry, you say there's an alcohol advertisement in Western Australia right now that's actually using the tactics of the alcohol industry.
Yeah, it's an ad against drink driving, and it catches your attention because the music and the voiceover sound just like a 1970s Swan Lager ad. And then right at the end, they turn it round and they say, you deserve it, and he gets caught for drink driving. It's a very clever ad.
Michael?
Yeah, I think that's a good ad as well. I must say I'm much happier with that. I know that Adam talked about the enjoy the ride sort of slow down ad. I'd like to see the research on the benefits of that. I think that's a really clever ad, and it is telling you there will be consequences. Just as in New South Wales, do you remember those great ads about drink driving? How will you go when you sit for the test? Will you be under 05 or under arrest? And they drew your attention to the consequences, and there were police cars around, and they worried you about them. So I think drawing people's attention to consequences is important. But, and again, you know, Adam and I are saying the same sort of thing. We do have to make sure that our advertising is very carefully researched, not least because if you're working in government or non-government organisations, you're spending public money and you can't afford to make mistakes. But we need to have the most impact we possibly can for a relatively small amount of money. And I think one area there, and I'd be interested in Adam's view, one area there where people in the health arena have an advantage over the commercial arena is that we can get, if you like, support publicity for our advertising campaigns. You know, you launch an ad, a commercial for a beer or a chocolate, and you can't have, you won't be on television news, you won't be on radio news and all that kind of thing. And we can multiply the effect of our health campaigns through that means, and I think we've got to get even smarter at doing that.
That's also one of the other correlates, I think, with success for these types of campaigns is how PR-able it is. And I think the onus is on the people doing the campaigns and coming up with these ideas to make it easy for it to be PR-able and have some kind of hook in it that makes media want to get involved in the campaign.
Yeah, thanks so much for the call, Jerry. Marie, you say shock tactics as once were used in school programs. It used to be pretty intense.
Yes, Tony. I went to school in King's Cross, and fortunately the school principal, she was really into the situation up there back in the 70s. We had, you know, all the hippie scene and lots of drug situations up there, and she got the drug squad in, and they gave us a lecture about, you know, the drugs, where you can go with them, you know, if you start with marijuana, etc. But they put up a film, and you showed a drug place where people were on the ground just lying around with, and they'd run out of veins, and with that they started injecting their eyeballs. And, of course, we all freaked out. And actually, it did work. Like, we all then went, wow, why would you get into that? And I just think it's a bit like the Grim Reaper ad. It was sort of like a shock to everybody. But I do know with the schools, they're doing the car accidents at schools now, where someone turns up that's been in a car accident and they were at school and they've had to be become paraplegic and that, and they put the alcohol into that too, you know, driving. So I think that if we went back to the schools with these shock tactics for a start. You know, and then at least it's sort of at the ground roots.
Yep. Adam, those first-hand reports, obviously they do tend to drive a message home.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's going back to what Mike says, shock tactics do work. And I think those actually, as far as I'm aware, those programs are still in the schools for various behaviours, such as anti-speeding. They do show very graphic films of people getting smashed and crashed in cars and so forth. And they leave a lasting impression. It's a little bit like operant conditioning in A Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, they can be useful. I think it's important, though, to remember that the evidence we have is that, by and large, one-off visits to schools aren't as good as consistent education. And unfortunately, sorry to come late in on a down note, first of all, we can't rely on schools to do everything. We've got to be doing the other things as well that Adam and I have been talking about, mass media, legislation, and so on. And second, if you look at the new Australian national curriculum, health and physical education isn't even in the top two tiers. The arts are there, but alcohol and drugs and tobacco and sex education and mental health, that's not even in the top two tiers. So we're really going to be working on very short diets there, and I think that's something that also needs to change.
Guys, thanks so much for being there tonight. Really appreciate your input. Adam Ferrier from the advertising agency Cummins Ross and Mike Daub, a professor of health policy at Curtin University. Thanks, guys.